Lend us your ears. Download the ABC Listen app and find all our audio in one handy place. Tap on your local ABC radio icon to go to the local station page and find our live shows, audio segments, catch-up programs and more.
This is the Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Great to have your company on this Thursday. In the next hour, let me share this statistic with you. It's from the state government and speaks to Queensland's significance as a beef processor. It says in a typical year, almost 50% of all of Australia's beef and veal products are processed in this state. Now, that industry is aiming to diversify its workforce. Have you considered a role in beef processing?
Women are a really important part of our workforce. It's really important to have diversity in our processing plants.
More from the Australian Meat Processor Corporation. Also, concerns about the progress of the inland freight route. That's the one between Mungindi and Charters Towers.
That is significant for freight efficiency, but it's also significant for our journey towards low carbon, where you can add a trailer or two to a journey. You're significantly decreasing the fuel burn per tonne of freight move.
More from the Queensland Trucking Association to this hour. Plus, we'll check in on the weather. Certainly a cold snap for southern parts. We'll speak to a senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. But first today, Australian labour hire companies and agribusiness owners should face 10 years in jail if they deliberately underpay workers. That's according to the policy think tank, the Grattan Institute. The calls for harsher federal penalties come as new global reports say there are 40,000 modern slaves in Australia. Fiona Broom reports.
The Walk Free Foundation's Global Slavery Index has found Australia is among the world leaders in stopping worker abuses in global supply chains. But the foundation says there are still around 40,000 modern slaves right now in Australia, with migrant agriculture workers at high risk of exploitation. At home, a report from the Grattan Institute found migrant worker exploitation continues, including wage theft from the critical workers who get our food from the fields to the shelves. Trent Wiltshire from the Institute explains the scale of exploitation.
With agriculture, we do find that that is one of the worst industries in terms of underpayment, but the numbers are a little bit rough. But we do know from previous work by the Fair Work Ombudsman and by other different surveys that the extent of underpayment in agriculture is probably, if not the worst industry, one of the worst industries, along with, say, hospitality as well. Most employers do the right thing, but we still find that underpayment and exploitation is a widespread problem, particularly with migrant workers.
Your report notes that many agribusinesses were found to be non-compliant by Fair Work in 2018, and when they were revisited 2 or 3 years later, they were still not compliant. That included more than 55% of investigations that found that workplace laws had been breached, and nearly 30% of investigations revealed wage theft. What does this suggest about how effective the Fair Work Ombudsman is? Is it doing its job?
Those figures you mentioned for agriculture were certainly concerning. We think the Fair Work Ombudsman is not doing a good enough job of enforcing workplace laws. In addition, we think the government also hasn't given the Fair Work Ombudsman enough powers to really punish employers that do the wrong thing. So it's not purely the Fair Work Ombudsman's fault. It's a combination of its lack of powers, but also not pushing hard enough and cracking down on employers that are doing the wrong thing. And that really doesn't work in terms of deterring rogue employers from doing the wrong things.
What's the solution then? What are your suggested reforms?
We think it needs more powers and more resources to do its job better. So stronger penalties, larger fines for employers that deliberately underpay their workers. We think there should be a maximum penalty of 10 years jail. We think the funding needs to be boosted significantly so the Fair Work Ombudsman can undertake more investigations, send more Fair Work inspectors out to make sure that businesses are compliant. So we're suggesting a $60 million boost to the funding of about $170 million a year. So that takes up to about $230 million a year. That's back to where it was, about where it started in 2011-12. We also think that there needs to be a review of the Fair Work Ombudsman to make sure it has the right culture and capability to enforce the law. And that includes renaming the Fair Work Ombudsman the Workplace Rights Authority to reflect its role as being an enforcer of laws rather than just a mediator.
You mentioned a change to penalties there, a maximum penalty of 10 years jail for wage theft or deliberately underpaying workers.
It's actually in line with what the Queensland and Victorian state governments have on their books in terms of wage theft laws. The Albanese government is looking at imposing criminal penalties for wage theft, and that consultation process is underway at the moment. We think that a criminal penalty is important to really, you know, have that strong deterrence for clear cases of deliberate underpayment. So we're very clear in the report. We don't want to capture businesses that underpaying on a technicality or just underpaying. We're really focusing on that really egregious behaviour. But we also think, you know, businesses should devote more resources to making sure they're complying with the law. So that criminal penalty is a real deterrent. Hopefully it's not used very often. Hopefully the deterrent effect starts to get more compliance with the law. But it needs to be there to show that, you know, breaching these laws is a serious offence. We don't take breaches of workplace law seriously enough at the moment.
The Grattan Institute also says that the working holiday visa extension requirement for regional work is a clear driver of exploitation and should be scrapped. Here's National Farmers Federation Vice President David Jahinki.
As agriculture, there is no room for people doing the wrong thing. There is absolutely unacceptable behaviour that has a slight shone on it. So whatever we can do collectively to stamp that out is really the core of why the NFF and its family are wanting to engage in this conversation. We are serious about it and we do want to stamp it out, but we need to make sure everybody's playing their part. It can't just be farmers, it can't just be workforce, and the ombudsman and the laws that are created and also have to be navigated. It's a big piece.
David says that worker exploitation is a serious issue, but he says many agribusinesses rely on the current visa system that brings in short-term workers.
Backpackers are still an important segment. Working holiday makers are still an important segment of the agricultural workforce because of the seasonality and their flexibility to transition between different workplaces. And for us, until we find a different source, until there is a different visa system put into place, that is still an important sector of workforce requirements across all of agriculture. If I'm running an orchard and I need 200 workers for 2 weeks, that's the best system for me, which is once again why we need to have those other four pillars put into place, making sure that legislation is simple to follow, that the Workforce Commission, the Ombudsman, has got good resources to clamp down on anybody, and if there's a whistleblower policy, people can easily access that and get that assistance in. Farmers need to make sure that their obligations are fully understood, and we continue to do that. And that's that education piece that we're engaging in. And then finally, when they are going through workforce recruitment agencies or labour hire services, that there's a licensing of that to ensure that exploitation is stamped out. This is an absolute industry effort to get on top of this, and we acknowledge there's a long way to go, but we feel that having these conversations are healthy and a step forward.
That's David Jahinki. He's from the National Farmers Federation, speaking there with our reporter Fiona Broome. Now, ABC Rural has reached out to the Fair Work Ombudsman. We were told no one was available, but a spokesperson said the FWO was reviewing the Grattan Institute's report and considering its recommendations. We, the Country Hour, has also contacted some state lobby groups, GrowCom and the Queensland Farmers Federation. Both are yet to get back to us, but said they wanted to review the report before making any comment. I'd love you to join in to this conversation too. 0487 993 222. That's 0487 993 222. Do you have a view? Do you think something like 10 years in jail is fair if you deliberately underpay workers? That's 0487 993 222. That's our text line. So you can send me a text, just your name and where you're from. Now let's stay with migrant workers, but this time to a success story. Colombian Diana Sanchez came to Australia 3 years ago with what she describes as an intermediate level of English, but her desire to become more fluent has set her on a different trajectory, a leadership journey. Ms. Sanchez, a tertiary graduate and professional, worked both in the cut flower industry and as an ag consultant specialising in integrated pest management in Colombia. Her move from South America took her firstly to Melbourne in 2020 and then to the Darling Downs, where she's now employed in agriculture again. And while still overcoming having English as a second language, she's a seed analyst, which sees her working predominantly in the lab, but also in the field. She says a group called the Mulberry Project in Toowoomba was instrumental in gaining a place on the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation's TRAIL, Emerging Leaders Program.
I think that this experience is different to everyone, because once you are walking in the bush for 7 days, you are completely isolated with other 15 people that you haven't met before. Some of communication issues come, and then you have to solve things. And I can say that in generally speaking, I can solve and manage those things. But when stress comes, I'm a different person.
I think that's the way with everyone. But specifically for someone trying to communicate in one language, but really when you're raw and tired and exhausted, your native language obviously comes to the fore. Is that what happened for you?
Yes, that's right. And sometimes it's like you are trying to survive. You are under stress. And now, yes, we don't have a tiger that wants to eat us, but we have to deal with other issues. So under stress is like your first language wants to come out and express, and is in the way that you feel safest. And of course, you are immersed in an English culture and you have to deal with that. So that was maybe my biggest challenge there.
Diana Sanchez, your workplace then, and in terms of you as a professional in a workplace and that communication, tell me about that. I mean, obviously you've come back from this course and you're now, I think you've been in the employ of that company for around a year and a half now. How's that been as a challenge?
At the beginning, it was hard because, for example, I didn't have much experience expressing myself with numbers and many other technical words that I had to learn at first. So, yes, sometimes in order to give an accurate information, you have to know your technical vocabulary. So this was the first challenge that I had. Then I have to say that they have been really open and nice in the way they have taught me how to communicate.
Kindness is one thing, but sometimes in a workplace there are challenges, and working through those could be interesting too with English as a second language. How have you gone about that?
Practicing. Sometimes in my mind, I made scenarios about what can happen in the future. Or even though I learned, even though sometimes I don't have the words to say something, what I still do, is I write down my notes in a small notebook that I have, and then I practice how to say it later. And I learned that sometimes if I cannot fix the problem straight away, I have to come back and talk to the person later after I've practiced.
Which is contrary to what you culturally do, because you in your society in Colombia, it's a very direct society. That's what you told me.
Yes. And personally speaking, I am. So sometimes it's like I'm fighting with myself.
Yes.
Because there is nothing I can do with that. I would like to do it in that way, but also I understand that here there are some unwritten social rules. I'm not going to tell somebody something rude because it's not nice. And so I have to learn how to do it, and I have to practice again and find the best words to say something without missing the message that I want to transmit.
It sounds like you've had a lot of learnings. Obviously, the people who you work with have learned as well. But I'm interested in your take, especially with more migrants coming to Australia, mm-hmm. and especially in the agricultural space, we're often looking for people to work not only on farm, but at a more technical level for people with tertiary experience and a qualification to work in agriculture. What do you think the experience would be like, particularly from people from South America, if we're seeing increasing numbers of migrants wanting to come into agriculture? What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, that is good to think about it, because one main thing is in our English level in South America is not as good as in other countries. So there is going to be a challenge there, of course. But also I know that people from Latin America, they will be learning and they won't give up, for sure. And also it is important to think how we express, because if somebody is saying something that sounds rude, maybe that person didn't mean it. It's just the way you say things. And we don't have to take things personally. It's just something that is happening in a workplace. And also, I think we have to have some meaningful conversations about it in the way our cultures are. Because if I'm telling a person to go to an Australian rural area and they don't know what to expect there, it's frightening, because you are going to be exposed to something completely unknown. And we are always afraid of those things. Going to a main city is easier.
And we were talking before, it's not just from the migrants' point of view, probably from Australia and perhaps agriculture and the way they interact with people too. You made an interesting point about a lack of exposure.
Yes, that's right. If we don't know each other, it is difficult to be welcoming. I'm going to give you a clear example. There are some cultures in other countries that they don't like to have morning teas because they believe that they can eat all of their food at the end of the day. So what if, for example, you go to a place and you are not taking your morning tea?
You see,
it's rude.
Absolutely. What an interesting point. Yeah, if you're not having smoko, yeah.
Exactly. Okay, maybe both of us, the migrant person and the Australian one, have to understand everyone's culture. Yes, I have to maybe be more flexible taking the smoko time. And after that, yes, I can have my big lunch. But we cannot expect somebody to change their completely habits. For example, I have lunch every single day, a big lunch, not a big dinner. And everyone knows in my workplace that I take my time having my lunch because that is the way we do it in my country.
It's the little things, isn't it? That's Australian Rural Leadership Foundation's Emerging Leaders Program graduate, Diana Sanchez. It sounds like she's navigated the smoko situation smoothly. 22 past 12.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Don't forget, you can join in the conversation. 0487 993 222 is my text line. Otherwise, you can call in 1300 747 222. That's 1300 747 222. To Transport Now, and the Queensland Trucking Association says it's concerned about the time it's taking for construction to begin on the inland freight route. The project, jointly funded by the state and federal governments, would see the Gregory Dawson and Carnarvon highways upgraded. So that's pretty much a straight line from Mungindi to Charters Towers. And the idea is it's an alternate route to the Bruce Highway, which is adjacent to the coast. Now, the Queensland Trucking Association CEO, Gary Mann, says the upgrades need to start urgently.
Oh, we're very concerned because it's a very important project. It was a significant priority commitment of the Premier at the last election. And at this stage, there hasn't been any works undertaken, but we're getting closer to that. They have appointed a project managers, and some preliminary work has been undertaken to select and agree on priorities. But 3 years down the track, we're very concerned to see works underway as soon as possible.
Why is this route so important for the trucking industry?
Well, it gives us an alternate route up through the central west. It gives us the opportunity to run multi-combinations on a regular basis. That is significant for freight efficiency, but it's also significant for our journey towards low carbon, where you can add a trailer or two to a journey. You're significantly decreasing the fuel burn per tonne of freight move. So when you look at the contra flows, you might call it, as we have the alternate to the Bruce, the connection to Toowoomba, the ever-increasing importance of Toowoomba as a freight hub, decisions being made around inland rail, which is highly likely to terminate at Toowoomba. So the connection down the Warrego to Roma, that route through the centre up to Townsville, the growth of North Queensland, you add all that together and that's really the substantial makings and significant foresight, we think, over the next 10 to 20 years for a genuine freight network around our state.
In terms of agriculture, what are some of the major uses of that route? Do we see mostly cattle or horticulture? What goes through there?
Certainly cattle would be a significant user. You've got a lot of grain, general freight. There's a variety of other ag products that would utilise it. You've got the Central Highlands looking at creating a logistics hub around Emerald. Toowoomba has already got the significant makings of a logistics centre, and Townsville the same for North Queensland. So when you can put a road system in place that gives you reliable alternatives regardless of the weather, and particularly for efficient road freight, that's the basis upon which economies are built.
And Gary, I guess just what's your message to both the Queensland and federal governments about upgrades to this road?
Well, it took substantial time for the understanding to come through with government. We got significant acknowledgement for that investment to be made, and we would expect that investment commitment to for the government to stand by it.
I guess you've mentioned that the project manager has been appointed, but any concerns about the time it's taking to actually get to construction?
Oh, we are quite concerned. I mean, it large road projects do take time to move from concept to works being undertaken, but we're now well over 3 years down the track. We're expecting to see works being undertaken in the very near future.
That's Gary Mann, the CEO of the Queensland Trucking Association, speaking with David Chen. Now, we've contacted the office of the Queensland Transport and Main Roads Minister, Mark Bailey, but we haven't heard back as yet. Now, are you job hunting? Would you consider working in Queensland's $4.92 billion beef product industry? That's coming up next.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So if you're looking at gaining employment, have you ever thought about a job in the red meat industry? It's something the Australian Meat Processor Corporation wants you to consider with their More to Meat campaign. It's being rolled out across regional Australia. It's on billboards, buses, and of course across social media. Vanita Chappell, the Industry and Government Relations Director at the Australian Meat Processor Corporation, has told our reporter Lucy Cooper the campaign is informed by months of research.
AMPC launched the More to Meat campaign last year to raise awareness about the role of processors in Australia. And one of the processing industry's strengths is the jobs that it creates directly and indirectly in regional communities. So we've actually rolled the campaign out to regional communities across the nation. The campaign's actually telling the stories of real people and the variety of jobs that they do in our sector. And it's actually started a conversation around the country about our industry sector and all the roles and the opportunities that are available.
What was the aim of the campaign? Who were you trying to attract?
The aim was actually to, the original aim of the campaign was actually to help inform people in the regions about what red meat processors do, how they contribute to the community, the types of jobs and opportunities that are available, the huge, this huge amount of red meat that we provide to export markets and also produce and process locally, for people in those communities. And basically what we were trying to do with the campaign was actually help people understand a little bit more about what we do. There was a lack of understanding about our role in the red meat supply chain. So that was the original goal of the campaign. It's been incredibly successful, even though it's only been running since August last year. And the great thing is that through the campaign, we've actually identified so many impressive people that work in our industry, and including many impressive women that have been attracted to our industry for different reasons.
How integral are women in the mission to fill labour gaps?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. As you all know, in throughout the country, there's a shortage of people in our in various industries. Red meat processing is no exception to that. It's really important that we are constantly attracting, you know, people from all walks of life with all different types of skills, men and women, you know, young and, you know, and older experienced people as well. And women are a really important part of our workforce. It's really important to have diversity in our processing plants, and we've got a lot of capable young women that are coming up through through our industry and taking on leadership roles in areas like sustainability, you know, quality assurance, etc. And they bring a lot to our industry, and hopefully will attract other women to the industry as well.
How important is it to bring flexible working arrangements into the discussion about attracting women to a workforce like the red meat industry?
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually. I think, you know, with all the changes various countries have gone through over the last few years with COVID, different industries have had to adapt to that situation and also adapt to the not only the changing workforce but the shortage of people in different industries and the difficulty in attracting people to work in various jobs. And red meat processing is no different from that. So we've tried, you know, a lot of different ways to not only attract people to our industry, but also to give them, you know, what works for them. And, you know, work-life balance is very important for well-being and to enable people to spend their free time doing, you know, all the different things that people like to do, including spending time with their family or hobbies or studying. And so having that, having some flexibility in the way red meat processing employs people means that it actually opens up opportunities for a much broader range of people to work in our industry. So it helps them, but it also helps our industry as well.
That's Vanita Chappell, the Industry and Government Relations Director at the Australian Meat Processor Corporation. Thanks to Lucy Cooper for that story. There'll be more around that subject in tomorrow's Queensland Country Hour and a story on our webpage, abc.net.au/rural. Or as we always say, shove it in a search engine, ABC Rural, and it will take you right there. We're coming up on the Queensland Country Hour. A couple of years back, our Sunny Coast reporter Jennifer Nichols and I reported from the Tom Quilty Gold Cup. Well, guess what? It's heading back to Imbul in 2023. You'll have a special report from Australia's National Endurance Championship and find out how many people are nominating for that event. Now, though, let's find out what is making news. Very good afternoon to Ellie Bradfield.
Hi, Ali. A 45-year-old man charged with the attempted murder of two police officers on the Darling Downs has been remanded in custody after a brief mention in court. Bartholomew Peter Dornbush was charged last night over the incident at Maringindan, about 20 kilometres north of Toowoomba. It's alleged the two officers had tried to intercept a truck which had been stolen from a property in Oakey earlier in the day. Police say when the officers went to open the truck door, it accelerated, trapping them between the truck and their police car before they were thrown across the bonnet and onto the road. 54-year-old Detective Senior Constable Steve Ingerson remains in Princess Alexandra Hospital in a stable condition and is in an induced coma. Hundreds of opal miners in western New South Wales have had their livelihoods cut off after the discovery of a government administrative error rendered their licences invalid. The state's Natural Resources Minister says a departmental review found 827 miners in Lightning Ridge and 31 in Whitecliffs were granted invalid mining licences. Lightning Ridge opal miner Ian Woodcock says there was widespread confusion and panic in the small town. And Ali, a true gentleman of the Northern Territory cattle industry who helped lead a successful class action against the live cattle export ban, has died aged 83. Colin Brett's family were lead claimants in the class action against the federal government's snap ban on the live cattle trade to Indonesia in 2011, which the federal court later ruled was unlawful. Remembered as a generous and remarkable man who exuded positivity, Mr. Brett was known to be very quick with a smile and always kind with his words. That's a lovely tribute. More news at 1.
Vale, Colin Brett, thank you very much, Ellie Bradfield. Mr. Brett, of course, owned a property called Tamis in the Charters Towers District, a very well-known cattleman across all of northern Australia. I'll never forget interviewing him at Morton Coe's Grassdale feedlot when he was trucking cattle from Waterloo, that property, big station, I should say, on the Northern Territory, Western Australian border, all the way down to that feedlot near Dalby. He'll be missed by many. Let's jump in and find out a little bit more about what's happening weather-wise. Kimber Wong is the senior forecaster. Good afternoon, Kimber.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
The regular spots getting the rain, Mount Sophia, 60 millimetres. I think there was 69 millimetres at Bucklands. That's in the last 24 hours. There's still been a bit of rain in that same area since 9 a.m. and even in the last hour, to be honest. But that sort of coastal and adjacent area doesn't hold the title as being the wettest spot in Australia for nothing. So we're always going to see rain in that part of the world.
It seems that way, yes. So today is no different. As you say, still a couple of showers around that Cassowary coast. And just with the southeasterly winds along the coast today, we have had a couple of light showers around the Whitsunday coast as well. So a little bit here and there, but that's pretty much it in terms of rainfall across the state for today and even the next couple of days. So tomorrow we'll still see maybe a couple of showers around that Cassowary coast, more exposed sort of coastline there that doesn't like to miss out. But it's really on an easing trend as we head into the weekend, so finer conditions even for the North Tropical coast there as we head through the weekend this weekend.
And dry as a bone till Monday. Yeah, look, I'm just looking forward. Heck.
Exactly, yeah. In fact, even through the early days of next week after Monday, Tuesday, still looks pretty much dry across the state. And it's probably not until the middle of next week or the second half of next week when we start to see the winds bringing in a little bit more moisture along the coastline once again and perhaps starting to return a couple of showers to that North Tropical coast in particular. But until then, it's dry.
Which takes us to the temperature, because it's that dry situation that's really part and parcel of what we're going to experience in the next couple of days. Although, just looking this morning, I think the lowest temp was, as usual, Applethorpe. No surprises there. Minus 1.5 degrees at about 10 to 7 this morning. Around the same time, not far from where I am, it was 1.7 degrees. And I've got a report, there was a bit of fog around still in my part of the world. That's sort of south-southwest of Toowoomba, not too far from the World Camp Airport. So it's chilly, it's autumnal, but it's going to be chillier.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, you know, how much colder can it get below minus a couple of degrees?
Yeah.
We did have a few minus fives in recent weeks. I can't remember if that was a couple of weeks ago now. Yes, we are looking at a cool change coming through and becoming pretty widespread across the state as we head through the course of the weekend. So this is all very much linked with a trough and a strong cold front that's mainly coming across the southeastern states. But that cooler air mass will start to spread up into Queensland as well over the next couple of days. So that will bring quite fresh and gusty westerly winds to the southeast corner as we head through the day tomorrow. But before that, it will bring pretty gusty southerly winds to much of western Queensland as well during the course of tomorrow. So that will probably feed in a little bit of that sort of wind chill factor to the temperatures tomorrow. And then once that cooler and drier air mass really settles in place across the state, we'll see those much cooler overnight temperatures in particular becoming more widespread through the course of the weekend. So areas that have seen slightly milder minimum temperatures, maybe not dipping quite so low into the single digits across, say, places like the Central Highlands Coalfields, Northern Goldfields, Upper Flinders in recent days, these sorts of areas are going to start feeling that cooler change coming through as we head through the course of the weekend. So really spreading a little bit more broadly across central and northern Queensland as we head through this weekend, which may be a bit of a change.
Crack out your beanies, those people in NQ. It might be socks and thongs weather you know, at this
Yeah,
rate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was just looking at the temperatures for Cairns, and while that that cooler change won't be probably quite so noticeable there, it will be noticeable. Our minimum temperature's been sitting sort of around 20 degrees in Cairns, and we're probably going to see that drop down into the teens or even the mid-teens by the time we get to early next week. So it will be a noticeable change there. Of course, the Atherton Tablelands is always an interesting one. At this stage, it doesn't quite look like we'll get cold enough temperatures to see frost there through the course of the weekend. But nevertheless, some minimum temperatures in the single digits may be possible. But then morning frost probably will be a pretty high likelihood for areas, you know, the ranges inland of Mackay, across the central west and down through the Maranoa, Warrego and Darling Downs and Granite Belt, of course. Those sorts of favourable hot spots for, well, cold spots, I suppose, for frost over the next few days. But probably not so much tomorrow, but from Saturday.
And the sheep graziers warning, you know, as the name suggests, mainly for people, for wool growers, for people with sheep or indeed people who are farming meat sheep, that perhaps the weather could kill livestock. But I suppose it's a warning for all livestock owners, whether you're thinking about what weight rug to throw on your pony or thinking about, you know, dogs. But specifically for sheep, what's that and wherefore?
Yeah, a really good question. So that warning to sheep graziers has been issued this morning for conditions through the Darling Downs and Granite Belt tomorrow. So tomorrow, that really is when those stronger west-southwesterly winds will be coming through in combination with those cooler temperatures. So wind chill may pose a risk to some of those more exposed and vulnerable livestock. So that's what that warning is for. And when we're talking about the wind strengths, look, much of western and southern Queensland, including the southeast corner, may see wind strengths around that sort of 30 to 40 kilometres per hour as mean winds during the course of tomorrow, particularly during that sort of late morning and afternoon. And gusts may be sort of the order of 60 to 70 kilometres per hour. So really quite gusty conditions coming through with this this weather system. But the winds will gradually ease back as we head into the weekend. So it's really just the one day, Friday, where we're expecting that sheep graziers warning in particular to be current for.
And in terms of frost, sometimes wind can be helpful. I mean, some farmers have frost fans, so the wind can be helpful. But could there be a black frost in parts just with this cooler weather coming through, or is it a bit too specific?
Yeah, that's probably a bit too specific. I wouldn't have thought so with this case. And particularly with those stronger winds coming through tomorrow, that's sort of ahead of the coldest air mass starting to come through as well. So really the frost becoming more widespread as those winds settle out during the course of Saturday and Sunday mornings.
And just finally, this cold spell, how long will it last? Are we thinking till Wednesday, or how long is a piece of string? Sorry to bombard you with these sorts of specific questions.
It is a very good question. And look, honestly, for some, I mean, the cold spell has already started. So these temperatures have been cool already across southern inland parts of the state. Tomorrow will be a bit of an odd one because we might have a subtle rise in temperatures, particularly across eastern parts of the state, just ahead of that that frontal system coming through. And with those slightly warmer temperatures and some very modest moisture, you did mention fog before, so it would be remiss of me to mention that chance of some morning fog in our more sheltered areas, you know, valleys and the like across eastern parts of the state, so roughly sort of south of about Rockhampton tomorrow. So just take care on the roads if you do encounter some reduced visibility, I suppose, there. And then how long is this cold spell lasting? That's the question. For central and southern inland parts of the state, it's probably not at least until the middle of next week before we start to see those temperatures starting to climb back up. But it's going to be several days in a row where we're having those very cool temperatures. A lot of locations are going to see minimum temperatures in the low single digits, approaching freezing or dipping below freezing, similar to what we've had in the last few days or earlier in the month as well.
Kimber Wong, Woolly Boots, Chop the Wood, Flanny Sheets, compulsory by the sounds. Thank you so much.
Sounds good to me.
Take care. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Senior forecaster at the Bureau, Kimber Wong.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, less mastitis, faster milking turnarounds, healthier beef cattle and improved weight gain are just some of the reasons that farmers have gone from shunning the Lake Barron Catchment Care Group's help to actually seeking its help. As President Peter Stevens told our reporter Jennifer Nichols, collaboration has also created crucial wildlife corridors between remnant forest and kept mud from silting up the Sunshine Coast's major water supply.
I've been president of the group for 23 years. When I joined that group, It was a very small community-based group, as it is now, and it really didn't have much in the way of income to achieve anything in the catchment. But I'm glad to say that these days we do have a multi-million dollar budget and we do have five permanent staff. So things have come along a long way, as has our whole community and the way in which agriculture operates in this region. Yeah.
Now, when you started, how hard was it to get farmers on board, and compare that to today?
Well, there were two problems, really. One was getting the money, and in hindsight, that was the easy part. But Aquagen, as it then was, did give us a six-figure sum and said, please go for it and test the waters and see what the reception is of farmers towards large-scale on-ground projects. And that's when the problem started, really, because, you know, the first number of farmers I approached, they really weren't interested in taking that money. And there were various reasons for that. Some saw it as a handout, which they didn't want. They were proud farmers, if you like. Some saw it as somebody interfering in their business and what they did with their land. Some thought we were tree huggers and were only interested in planting trees or something. Bring people on board, if you like. That was a five-year process to gain trust of landholders. And luckily enough, one or two key landholders based in the region, among them Hoppers, did take up early grants. And that gave other landholders confidence to deal with us. And when they saw how we were operating, they became more confident that they could trust us. And we could trust them, if you like, also. And so that was a long establishment process. And now I would say we would probably be working with 90% of the larger rural landholders in this district. We had a deliberate strategy not to plant trees back in those days because trees were difficult. They were expensive to put in the ground and maintain. We actually did hard landscaping works, you know, laneways, off-stream watering, that kind of thing, because those kind of projects, you implement them quickly and they give 100% effect immediately and there are no ongoing issues with it.
So for people who haven't come across this concept before, this is all about stopping hard hooves, cutting up the ground, adding to silt going into the Sunshine Coast major water supply.
Absolutely. Our whole focus is to try to improve the water quality entering our streams and dams, and we undertake any project that contributes to that. It could be planting of trees, it could be fencing out of waterways, it could be hardening of laneways, it could be providing alternative water sources other than dams and streams. Yeah.
Which is also beneficial for animal health and weight gain.
Yeah, a number of the farmers were particularly surprised to notice that those gains for farmers and production and management were in fact quite extensive and quite valuable. You know, the dairy herds would get into the bales in half the time they normally would. And when they arrived, they wouldn't have mastitis that they might normally have in bad weather conditions. So in fact, a number of the more progressive farmers immediately realised that those kind of structural improvements actually did make a difference to herd health and management and staff costs.
How many plantings has Lake Baroon Catchment Care Group made? Have you ever tallied them up?
All I can tell you for sure is that previously we didn't plant a lot of trees. This coming financial year, we will have 180,000 trees under management in the ground. That's either being planted this year or under maintenance. Normally we maintain our trees 3 to 5 years. In fact, it's almost got to the point where to secure more trees or more contractors to maintain them is actually becoming difficult because of the demand. So it's been quite a massive shift, and perhaps in the earlier days we've done a lot of the structural work, and what we actually see is farmers taking a much more different attitude towards trees and understanding that actually they are part of a successful farm and don't need to affect production at all. In fact, can actually be an asset to the farm.
Driving through the landscape and seeing those riparian corridors repaired and less erosion and wildlife being able to move through the pieces of remnant forest, it must be very satisfying.
This was something we tried to point out to a number of people really quite early on, including councils and funding bodies. The waterways in this area really act as conduits through the landscape. The houses sit on the high ridges. The farms occupy everything else, and in those depressions are the streams and creeks, and they form a network through the whole catchment. If you can return those to something resembling good health, reasonable tree cover, they do act as pathways for all kinds of things, and they form this brilliant network, and people, you know, we're seeing all kinds of things moving around that weren't there before because of that. And these aren't very large or even wide areas of ground, but they're extremely important because you don't want, or it's difficult for wildlife to traverse over roads or through those ridges, because that's where the housing is.
That's Lake Baroon Catchment Care Group President Peter Stevens. Let's stay in that Sunshine Coast region to Queensland's Mary Valley, where horse enthusiasts are preparing to host Australia's National Endurance Championship, the Tom Quilty Gold Cup. It's a gruelling 160k race across 24 hours, a race steeped in history and folklore. It was first conceived in 1966 by R.M. Williams to create a new way to test horse and horsemanship in a world that had moved on from droving. Keeping the Tom Quilty going has become more challenging, but the passion for the sport is still strong. Tessa Mapstone reports.
We could have 300 horses milling to go out the gate at midnight. And, you know, it's amazing how those horses cope with that excitement, the anticipation, and what they're being asked to do, you know?
That's Kim Moyer, one of the organisers of this year's Tom Quilty Gold Cup, which is being held at Imbul in the Mary Valley. And what those horses are being asked to do is carry their riders through a 160-kilometre course within 24 hours.
They don't actually spend 24 hours in the saddle, because at the end of every leg they must have a one-hour break, which is when horses are assessed by vets to ensure they are fit to continue. So we're very conscious of horse welfare. A lot of riders for some of the more challenging parts of the track will also get off and run with their horse. They actually help to preserve the horse by not putting weight on the saddle when it's a difficult downward track or upward track or whatever, you know. They all go out at midnight, and then as they start coming in, which will probably be from about 3 in the morning, you watch the front runners, you want to know they've been successful, you watch them being vetted in, and you're thinking, have they got through? And from 3 o'clock in the morning, there will be a constant stream of horses coming in off leg 1, off leg 2, there will be 5 different, you know, legs that they do, and we anticipate the winner should be in by 1 to 2 time, you know, 1 in the afternoon. And remembering those riders will range in age from 12 to over 70.
Right.
Male and female doing exactly the same course. Our sport is 75% female membership. So, you know, in terms of endurance and achievement, it's quite a significant thing. You consider kids of 12 can be out there by themselves doing that ride. Men, women in the 70s can be out there doing that ride. So it's a real family-type intergenerational sport.
To make a ride like this happen, a lot of hands are required.
Our main requirement is to have people out in the forest at the checkpoint, and they set up communication points at various parts of the track. But there are other parts of the track where we have no signal, but we want people to be there. So we have somebody who can come and get help if we need be, and to mark off that horses have gone past that point. The main thing is to know where people are on the track, so if somebody doesn't arrive within the expected time frame, we at least have some idea of where they were at 1:55 a.m. or 3:40 or whatever, you know. So having those checkpoint people is very important. It's not something that everybody wants to do. Spend a couple of hours out in the Imbul Forest, you know, in the middle of the night. But for the right people, it's a nice spot to be. I mean, horses coming at you with headlights on
the
riders,
dark.
You know, is quite a spectacular.
COVID, floods and fires have hit the endurance riding community hard. The Cup was due to be hosted in Victoria this year, but 6 months ago, a new venue had to be found.
It gets harder to find 160 kilometres of track from a venue that can host, you know, certainly more than 200 horses with all their riders, strapping team, crews, whatever, you know. So Victoria were unable to do it, and Australian endurance riders called for clubs across the country to to put in a bid to host 2023. And because we had done it recently, we were able to pull together the same team, basically, with some fresh people. In 2019, we had 299 horses nominated. And we would have loved to have hit that mark again. But as I said, our membership has been knocked back a bit. And horses and riders must be qualified to do a 160. So a lot of people have been handicapped, I suppose, in getting access to rides. So a lot of our membership are not ready to do a 160. A lot of horses haven't been conditioned to do a 160. So that's knocked us back. But I'm hoping, looking at nominations now, that we should make 220, 230.
Despite the challenges, the Tom Quilty is still an event that attracts global attention.
I think there are three international riders nominated now, and I know there's at least another three. So, yeah, it does get worldwide attention. So the world will be looking at Imbolc at midnight on the 23rd of June.
That was Kim Moyer, one of the organisers of this year's Tom Quilty Gold Cup, Australia's national endurance championship this year at Imbolc at a purpose-built endurance facility. That story from Tessa Mapstone and Alex Easton. And a bit of a correction, there are still cattle in the long paddock in this state at least. So those disciplines of endurance riding still in place for those that choose to take their cattle on the road. But let's head west next to a project honouring Australia's heritage in the wool industry. 7 to 1.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
To a proposal that would see a Western Queensland wool scour revived, it's getting closer to a reality, according to the mayor of the Blackall Tambo Shire. The facility was proposed in 2020 in order to bring fleece-to-fabric processing back to Australia. Mayor Andrew Martin says the Kew Wool Board is now in talks to secure a block of land at Blackall with access to a bore for the facility. But as he tells our reporter Madeline McCosker, it's still years off completion.
We've had various discussions with various potential joint venture partners, all of them overseas joint ventures, none of them Chinese, for those who are on the cynical side. Those discussions are continuing. We're very excited about the reception we're getting from around the world, actually. There's still a little bit of, and it's onshore and it's fairly typical of Australia, you know. I thought there was bugger all in Blackall, but there's a bit of that going on. The state government has continued their talks with us and they're very positive about the project that we've got going. We've identified a bore and a block of land that will be the future site when we go ahead, at just not too far from Blackall. There's signs up there on the bitumen now saying this site is intended for the Queensland Wool Processors plant. I don't know when that deal will go ahead, but sometime later in the year we need to raise some more capital. We're talking to financiers, international financiers, I might say, who are very keen on the project that we've got at hand. It's not so much the problem of being Blackall per se, it's the problem of getting high-tech or technical staff to move from, Gladivostok, and I'm just using an international city, to come to an outback town. We don't have anyone in Gladivostok that wants to come to Blackall or doesn't want to come to Blackall, but you know what I mean. It's quite a major move for people, but that doesn't mean to say we can't train staff. That doesn't mean to say we can't get staff to train staff, and I would prefer to do it locally, quite frankly, and that's the whole idea of where we're going with Kewell.
Yeah, and as you said, it's sort of been ongoing now for a few years and you've been trying to raise some capital in that time. How much more money are you hoping to raise before you can put the money down and get that block and get things going in Blackall?
Look, to get to the financial investment decision, which is the FID, we probably need the best part of $1 million. We've spent the best part of $1 million. It's all positive. We wouldn't keep raising funds and keep going if we didn't think there was a hope of it working. The first phase will involve about $45 million worth of capital to build a plant and stock it with equipment. The eventual build will be about $200 million, and that'll be a fully blown, right through the dying the fabric and putting it on a boat to Bangladesh or to be made up somewhere or another. So it's we'll do it in good gradual stages. We're not going to try and double the population of Blackall in a week. We'll take a few years to get to where we need to be.
Yeah, so you think it's still, you know, between 5 and 10 maybe years away before it actually is built and running?
In fully blown, probably closer to 10 than 5, but certainly stage one, where we start scouring wool on a contract basis for whichever country or company you might like to name, you know, it could be 18 months to 2 years. Phase two would be, say, 3 to 5. And the big kaboomba, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10, I suppose. Depends on a whole heap of international imperatives and all those sorts of things.
That's the Mayor of the Blackall Tambo region, Andrew Martin, speaking there with Madeline McCosker. Let's check markets. Straight to the Warwick sheep sale, where the dip in prices was something to behold. It's a very good afternoon to Errol Luck.
Warwick agents bent 2,761 with 1,962 lambs and 799 grown sheep. With the heavy frost affecting the pasture, the quality of the yarding lacked finish, with the majority of the lambs penned dry store types, with only a small penny of lambs suited to the trade buyers, with store prices reduced from 7 to 18 across these lines. Lambs to feed lost $6, with those to restockers the most affected, dropping up to $64 a head. Hoggets lost 28, and heavy mutton to processors sold to firm rates. Young lambs to restockers made 51 to average 44. Lightweight crossbred lambs to restockers sold from 28 to 50, with Dorpers at 40 to 76, and those to feed selling to 82. Lightweight trade lambs sold from 30 to 88, and 20 kilo lambs to feed sold from 70 to 143 and averaged 110. Lambs to the wholesale meat trade sold from 130 to 156 and averaged 143, with a handful of heavy lambs to processors at 167. Hoggers to processors sold from 62 to 93 and averaged 79. Lightweight merino used with skin to restock a sold from 22 to 35, with heavy used to processors at 65 to 100.
Thanks, Errol Lark. 3,200 in Blackall today, according to Sam Hart. And crossbred weaner steers heading north. Saw some pretty good prices.
A total of 3,200 head were yarded for the monthly Blackall weaner and store sale. Overall quality of yearlings was good, with most cattle sourced from the local areas. Increased buyer support from northwest Queensland helped competition on crossbred lightweight restocker steers, and all the usual buyers were active on feeder pens. Lightweight restocker bulls sold to 398.2. Lightweight restocker steers sold to a top of 410.2 to average 385. And restocker steers 280 to 330 kilos made to 394.2 to average around 350 cents. Medium weight steers to the restocker sold to 358.2, while feeders paid up to 336.2 to average 320. Heavy feeder steers sold to 322.2, with most around 300.
Thanks very much to Sam Hart, and thank you for listening. And thanks to Chris and John for their text messages. We just couldn't get to them today. Lucy Cooper will be back with you from midday tomorrow. News time now, 1 o'clock.